Welcome to Emissaries of Profits, a production of Androids and Assets. This is a show where we examine the political economy of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We look at the wealth distribution, power structures, and conflict resolution in the Bajoran sector of the Alpha Quadrant, and occasionally just on the other side of the wormhole into the Gamma Quadrant. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven. And today we've got what has become a favorite episode of mine, actually. When I watched this, I was like, oh man, this is a good one. I like this one. So we were looking at The Storyteller, episode 13. Its initial air date was May 2nd, 1993. Thank you, Memory Alpha, for keeping track of all this for us. What did people do before you? And basically, the summary is there's an A plot and a B plot. I would say the A plot is Sisko's conducting negotiations for two rival Bajoran groups. And the B plot is Bashir and O'Brien respond to a medical emergency in a Bajoran small town. Shenanigans ensue. There's oatmeal in buckets and, O'Brien is at one point offered three prostitutes. I guess I shouldn't say prostitutes.
They weren't going to be
their
paid.
Their motivation was. That's true, I guess. Anyway, it's a wild ride. It's just a very wild ride. Boy. Yeah. Nonstop action. Plus, it's just good to see, experience the raw discomfort of O'Brien being in Bashir's presence in the early episodes.
So good.
I feel you, O'Brien. Yeah.
So the A plot with Sisko conducting negotiations. The negotiations are between these two rival groups, one of them led by Varys Sul, Tetrarch of the Paku.
And a female child.
Yeah. I mean, she can't be any older than 14.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. Roughly.
Yeah, 18 or early teen.
Quite early teen, yeah.
Spunky. Was a spunky tween.
Was a compatriot of Jake Sisko and Nog in the episode. So it was right in that age group. So, on the other side was Woban, leader of the Nevat.
A 45-year-old man.
Yeah.
Very, very middle-aged dude.
So Sisko got along real well with him and was super patronizing to Varys Sul. As you are with young women, right? I mean, generally, if you're talking to a young woman, you assume that she doesn't know anything.
I think this qualifies for what we would consider mansplaining. There are multiple confirmed instances. We're like, listen, you're a woman. When two people negotiate, one person, they talk to each other and decide things. That's what negotiations are.
One person gets what they want.
Yeah.
And the other person, you, give them what they want.
Yeah.
Come on, kid.
Yeah, and this is like
respect your elders.
Yeah, we really see Sisko. Yeah, because I think for the author, they were trying to be like, listen, Sisko is just trying to be a mentor to this young person. But how it comes off is basically like this, because Sisko is not actually her mentor. He doesn't have Varys Sul's best interests at heart. He has an outside benefit, presumably to the Bajoran central government, that he just wants this dealt with, and he doesn't want an internecine conflict in rural Bajor.
These two people have said they're willing to fight each other. The conflict is over a border, and the historic border was a particular river. And during the Cardassian occupation, the border's course was changed. So one group got extra territory and one group lost territory. And now they're not willing to settle this difference. And they're willing to kill each other over a 20-kilometer section of land, which, does happen on Earth and is something that we see all the time. But
China and India went to war for a 2-square-kilometer piece of land. At one point,
And I like if you look at like Israel and Palestine, Israel is regularly
fighting over 2 or 4 or 5 kilometer chunks, but systemically, it starts
right
when you do add that up. It's not just the
and then you got compounding interest,
compounding land accrual,
So like it's a completely realistic reason for conflict, except that the Bajorans seem to be a spacefaring species. And so the idea of controlling like a small territory on Bajor has far less weight when you can just go out and occupy an entire other planet. And the productive capacity of that land sort of comes into question of like, well, what are you producing? Or what does that 20-kilometer section of land have that you can't get anywhere else, or that, you know, is so unique that you're willing to kill over it in that day and age, right?
Yeah, when you have a if you have replicators, you're not farming. Are you farming? I guess. And if you're farming, like, we also know there's hydroponics bays and very intensive automated cultivation methods. So I don't think people are like being out there and. Are you positing that people are out there tilling the soil? Like, is this
right?
I mean, I could also see there being like an extreme deprivation, there's a very wide class divide. Like, maybe urban Bajorans are very advanced, but outside of the centers, like, it is actually just like a feudal land system.
So. Yeah, you've got like rural Bajorans who.
But then in that case, Verasul should be like, what the fuck?
In what way?
Well, just like she should just be like completely blown away by, like, you know, because she's in a whole other technology,
right,
level.
As soon as she arrives on the Deep Space Nine, would you be like, "Wow, you guys have a lot. Where are your farmers?"
Yeah, but anyway,
and she's not.
Yeah. So anyway,
I guess it could have like deep symbolic meaning. In which case, though, you would think, given how theocratic the Bajoran society is, there would be a religious leader stepping in and sort of saying, like, this is the ancient land of the Nevat people, and it was given to them by the prophets.
Yeah, or they would do some sort of like, well, due to the transitive principle, the river being the spiritual entity, the spiritual energy of the river changed when the river changed, and therefore the ancestral claim went with it, or did not. And, you know, and there'd be like some sort of metaphysical, they could do the metaphysical math, they could read the book and tell you. And that would be a far more effective modality of arbitration than Sisko coming up and trying to bully Verasul into getting in line.
Well, and it just makes like there seems very little rationale for why it takes place
at all.
Well, and especially on Deep Space Nine, like, let's leave this planet that apparently has either so much symbolic value or real value. Mm-hmm. We're going to leave it to go somewhere else and settle this dispute. Mm-hmm.
Why
would Sisko not go down to the disputed territory?
Well, and the only reason to leave and go to the Federation is for its proposed neutrality, which then Sisko fails to provide.
Yeah,
like the only outsized benefit to going to the Federation is like, listen, you don't give it. You've never heard of this before. You don't have a preformed opinion. Hear us out, you know.
Because we have multiple scenes where Sisko literally says to this girl, well, you know, by saying no, you're not going to do any good for your people.
How do you know that?
But if I say no, we keep the territory. Like, they're not offering us anything in exchange for it. They just want it back. But it's ours.
Well, and then this brings us to the ultimate solution, which is, Marshall, you wrote it down, right, when you were watching it? What is the deal they come to in the end?
Here's the thing is, Verasul is having difficulty. She's very upset because she's thinking like they're going to come to conflict, and she obviously doesn't want that, and is upset, and it's weighing heavily on her. So her two new friends, Jake and Nog, come barging into her room, and she says, "How would you solve this problem?" And Nog, being a good Ferengi, says, "Well, the ninth rule of acquisition." So cue the rule of acquisition music here. The ninth rule of acquisition states opportunity plus instinct equals profit.
Wow. Wisdom.
I mean, I get sort of the theme of that, that if there's an opportunity, but you have to be able to recognize that it's an opportunity, which I guess is where the instinct comes in, that if you can recognize the opportunity and make good on it, then you can profit off of it. And so he's saying to her, like, maybe there's something you can get out of this. Like, maybe there's something for you in it as well. What are you going to get? Okay, great. Good advice. Like, better advice than Sisko was giving, which was negotiating doesn't mean just saying no. Like, it's not worth dying over. He also asks her at some point, like, you might be willing to die over this, but are your people willing to die over this? Which I think is a really bold question from a person who literally sends people on missions to die. Has he ever asked anyone serving under him whether they're willing to die for the mission he's sending them on?
That's a very important rule of being a person who does, of being a military commander. You don't entertain, entertain that thought.
He's never asked that question before, but now it's super important. So the solution that they come to, her compromise, that's air quotes on the compromise there, is that she will give them the land back and they will maintain trade access on both sides of the river.
And I think it's really important. It's free trade access, which I think the operative word there being free trade in 1993 is significant.
Yes.
so when you give up the land and in turn some sort of like neoliberal special economic zone will be created out of this, which who knows, maybe they're well poised to maybe they've really fucked the Nevada actually with that, like who knows, like maybe they're really well poised to win
the Nevada have to continue to provide them 60% of the water flow from the river.
Yeah.
They can only ever reduce the amount of water flow by 1% of the last five year average decrease.
A 100 year agreement exit.
So the compromise that they actually reach, free trade access to both sides of the river, mm-hmm. which, yeah, I mean, who knows exactly.
That is entirely too jargony and nebulous to mean anything.
And as you pointed out, the free trade access in 1993. Being free trade is really quite a political term.
Yeah,
it's the height of like North American free trade and other free trade deals happening around the globe. Of like, we're not just opening like treaty negotiations; we're opening free trade deals to have free trade.
Yeah, and also then as a global system, like there'd be a global, and then the notion that there would be a collective surrendering of sovereignty. To facilitate that people can't individually, or the nations, I guess, not people, nations can't legislate in ways that interfere with the intercourse of commerce.
Free trade.
Yeah, which you know, when you hear people talking online about neoliberalism, I think this is one of the really hallmark examples of what that actually means.
Yeah.
Is this notion, neoliberalism being this notion that you might have a law that says it is unsafe to consume a certain type of product, but if that law is blocking a good that is for sale from entering your economy, that is not okay. It's not a permissible law.
No, exactly.
For you to have as a state. Now, maybe as a community or a sub-territory, it might be okay. But certainly, you can have a federal law against.
I think there was if I'm remembering it correctly, there was an interesting example that happened in Canada and the United States, is that there was a fuel additive that many American fuel companies, fuel producers, had been putting into their fuel, increasing stability, reducing knock, whatever, I don't know, made the fuel better in some way. But it was also like a horrific carcinogen and was directly traced with like causing bad things for people's health. So Ontario passed a law that said this fuel additive is not allowed in our province. And that was fine. But then Canada passed a law saying this fuel additive is not allowed in Canada. And the company that was making the fuel brought Canada up against the World Trade Board or the North American Free Trade Court, whatever that was. Mm-hmm. And it was ruled against and Canada's law was struck down saying you cannot impede upon this trade by passing a law saying that the product is illegal here because it's a trade system that already exists, which is, sort of like mind blowing.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and doubly hurtful when you consider then what happened in terms of Canadian softwood lumber.
Well,
down
yes.
the line, but that's a whole can of worms one needn't open. Essentially, yeah, this seems very one sided.
Ultimately,
when you look at it in deployment, and so what you said, you're asking people to give up their sovereignty in the name of fairness and equity, but it only seems to be fair and equitable when it's in service of certain members of these trade organizations.
Yes, so, the stronger party always gets better terms.
Yeah, so. It you can start to see, so you can see it. It's on the one hand, it's supposed to enhance peace, improve commerce, draw societies and people together. On another hand, when you look at it under the microscope, you tend to see a lot of predatory behaviors emerging. And so the thing is, the reason maybe the one reason the PACU could enter this is because they could maybe have certain advantages in terms of capital or resources that would really allow them to actually then not just. Like, they give up the land, but then they could actually gain bargaining and economic power over not just the land they formerly controlled, but then also they could actually maybe be making a play for the whole thing.
Right, yeah. So they might not have the agrarian power that they have right now, but they gain the greater power of, like, all of the... They own everything that the Nevat.
And the Nevat can't interfere with their business interests
right.
in any way, which is, you know, it's potentially extremely powerful.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful deal to get.
Yeah.
One would ask then why the Nevat would agree to that.
Because they really want
they
that
really
land
want
back.
That land, yeah.
They're blinded.
They're not savvy, yeah.
They don't have the instinct to take advantage of the opportunity.
Right. To equal profit. Yeah. This is what we love to dig into, I think, really, like, asking these questions about how all this works and what all this kind of means, in not just in the context of the world, but also in the context of the person who's ostensibly seeing it and what they're thinking. And this to me is where it gets actually kind of sinister, right? Because here you have free trade being proposed as a way to avoid conflict and violence. And when you drive at, like, the whole thing that's done, it's like Milton Friedman was like, states are, Milton Friedman, the Vienna Circle, all of these, like, you know, how would you describe these people, like, economically, their school of thought, like the Chicago School.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Austrian
school. Von Meisel, yeah, all these people. Their whole thing is like, yeah, we have this thing and it's brutal, but it's just business. And at least it's not coercive and violent, which is what happens when you have the state.
Yes,
the state
yeah.
brings coercion. The state brings violence. This is just business. And it might not seem fair, but it is peaceful and it is calm and it makes a better world.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the selling points often of these free trade deals is that they reduce global conflict.
They do not.
No. They might potentially reduce, like, large-scale, like, formal conflict. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they've ever reduced overall global conflict.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if you look at countries, so if you look at the main global conflicts we experience, they are largely between the collective of free trade neoliberal countries trying to depose the governments of the holdout countries.
Yes,
the
yes,
countries
yes.
that refuse to submit to global free trade agreements, and that's one of the cases. Like, a big example of that is Venezuela and Iran.
Yeah, yeah,
will not play ball. And of what a coincidence! These are constantly being brought to the brink of war with them, and may eventually one day spill out into outright war. And I think Iraq was also an example of that. Well, Iraq and Afghanistan were also both holdouts against global trade. So, yeah, I don't think it works as advertised.
No, not. It doesn't work necessarily like as nicely as advertised. But it has reduced. Like I said, like, large formal conflict of, like, oh, World War II, where this country and this country, because of an alliance, are at war with this. These other, like, large alliances, it's much more concentrated conflicts, right? Like you said, like, it's Iraq and Afghanistan. And that very easily, you know, you could have seen in just a few years past mm-hmm. blow up into something much larger when Russia says, well, we're allied with Afghanistan, and now you're at war with us, too. And then Russia's allies are pulled into it, right?
Well, this is where I say the confounding factor. And I don't think that piece is the byproduct of free trade agreements. And this notion that everyone's so invested and there's so much capital flowing around that no one would start a war because it would fuck with their cash. Because that's exactly the situation you have in on the eve of World War One, and it doesn't matter. There's massive capital loss when World War One breaks out. It does nothing. People having investments in all of the countries on Earth doesn't actually stop the war from kicking off. Anyway, but I think what you're really seeing there is actually the nuclear stalemate. The nuclear stalemate is actually blocking what you're talking about. It's being attributed. It's being misattributed.
Sure.
To neoliberal economics.
And that's what prompts like the end of history, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's what solicits. Yeah, this entire Fukuyamian thing comes out of that. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, Francis Fukuyama, I guess academic.
Sure.
Who I think he has a university post somewhere. And he wrote a book called The End of History. And like I said, when the Soviet Union fell, that was it. And we were all kind of just becoming more refined neoliberal subjects at that point. And then the grand narrative of Islamic terror resurged or appeared. And that was very clearly disproven. But, you know, what you going to do?
Yeah. I think also kind of, so talking about some of this free trade, I'm going to go back to talking about also Cisco and his mediation of this conflict between the Paku and the Nevad. Because I think, like, we sort of talked a little bit about, like, his role and, like, that he's not actually a neutral party.
No, he's right. Not. He's, yeah, definitely has a vested interest.
And sort of the necessity of having a neutral party. Because, like, he definitely has, like, an agenda, and that's fine. Like, he's allowed to have an agenda, and everything.
He wants peace on Bajor for the central government, so the central government will stay happy with the Federation's outpost on the wormhole,
right? And maybe the central government like appointed him arbiter of this. I'm not sure. I don't know how he got the role.
That would be bad. That would be however they did it, but that would be arguing in bad faith of them.
Certainly it would. But I think like a good example of what happens when you don't have this like neutral third party arbiter is the Middle East peace process right now. The United States has multiple times sort of said, "Oh, we're gonna negotiate peace in the Middle East," maybe at one point, you know, they could have been viewed as a neutral party who was actually there, you know, to help two sides come to a resolution.
Yeah.
But most recently, there's been the Trump deal administration, you know, I'm going to make peace in the Middle East. I've got this thing.
I'm going to send Jared Kushner, a man who has personally given money to the Likud party, and I'm going to send him as I'm the neutral third party.
Right.
And you know, a man who had BB stay at his house when he was a child.
This is the Trump administration that moved the capital.
Yeah.
Accepted the change of the capital and moved the embassy to Jerusalem and said, yes, we are recognizing the capital of Israel as Jerusalem.
Which is a huge deal for a whole bunch of reasons we don't have time to get into.
No, but I mean, both sides have called it their capital or want parts of it as their capital.
Yeah.
And so to just unilaterally grant it to one side, right, really calls into question your neutrality there. Mm-hmm. And the United States is for a long time been a staunch defender of Israel, and this president, more so than many others, very strongly is like, Israelis are correct.
Yeah. It belongs to Israel. Palestinians are in the way.
So when he's now saying, well, we are going to find peace in the Middle East, we're going to make this happen, his deal was rejected out of hand almost before it was released by the Palestinians because they said, there is no way that a peace deal mediated by someone who is not neutral will benefit us.
And looking at the deal, they would be correct.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know all of the details. From what I heard briefly on it, it sounds like it would be terrible for the Palestinian people. Like, it just would not be a good deal at all. But the Paku and the Nevad, at this point, like, the Paku would be saying, well, you are coming to us and you're saying, why don't you just give it back to the Nevad? Why don't you give this land back? Come on, like, you know you deserve, they deserve it, you gotta give it back. Why would this person
acquiesce to that request?
Right. They're like, well, you're not neutral here. And you're saying that the other side should just get what they get. Like, where is your sort of like, what's your token of faith here that lets me believe that you're actually neutral? And why would I give in to something that is on the face bad for me just because you, who's not neutral? Like, at that point, you should be like, no, we're definitely not giving this back. Like, you're not neutral,
yeah,
and you want us to give it back. That probably means we shouldn't give it back.
Yeah, on principle, then, you should exit the negotiation because the negotiation is clearly rigged. And this is exactly what Palestine.
Right.
But both Palestine, both Palestinian groups, both Hamas and, you know, both Hamas and Fatah, both Hamas and the Palestinian government in the West Bank, both rejected it. Like, you know, just completely forthwith. So, and they're right too, I think. That's rational of them to do so.
So I think that's kind of like, that's why these things are like, oh my goodness, wow. Because, again, the Federation sort of plays that proxy role of being the United States.
Yes.
We're the United States. We'll go in. We'll be the mediators. Yeah. Don't worry. We're neutral. We're the world police. And that's the Federation's role. We're the galactic police. That's fine. You guys have some conflict. We'll come in. We'll settle it. We're neutral.
We'll just give everything to Bechdel.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. We've solved your problem for you.
Done.
You owe Bechdel $50 billion, and maybe some roads will get built eventually. But anyway, so that's that, the A-plot, I guess.
That's the A-plot. It's a pretty gross abuse of power by Sisko.
Which is not new.
No, that's what he does.
That's
why he's there.
Par for the course for Sisko.
The B-plot is... Chef's kiss. Bashir and O'Brien get to fly in a shuttle to Bajor. And it's actually a kind of interesting examination of the relationship between like an enlisted person and an officer, which is something that we don't really get a lot of in Star Trek.
Or actually for a society that's as martial as we are, and has as much military content in our media, it's actually seldomly addressed in it at all. Like, but this is actually a huge part of military life that I think a lot of people don't even realize. Like, that there is actually, like, there are two classes of people in the military.
Right.
There are officers and there are enlisted personnel. And if you're an enlisted personnel, everyone in the entire officer class is your superior.
Yes.
Regardless of their position.
Someone who is, like, an ensign, just fresh officer... Like, this is like the lowest of the low officer outranks
the most senior enlisted soldier. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and there are some loopholes there that, you know, and some, like, there's some actual real technicalities of, like, certain enlisted positions outrank some particular officer positions.
But we actually see an interaction where this plays out, and it's Bashir and Bashir being a real, I mean, Bashir having power over O'Brien. But also being a real asshole, being really coy about it.
Well, right? And I think some of this is also weird for Bashir in some ways, because he's an officer, but he's a doctor, right?
Yeah, he's not actually a commanding
unit. Yeah. So he's not a command officer. He's not, and I don't think he ever thinks of himself as being an officer.
Yeah, he doesn't see himself as being in the chain of command.
Yeah, he sees himself as just being, you know, he's a doctor. And sure, he holds that rank, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is that he's a doctor. Which is cute because he has the option to assume that.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is often how class impacts people, right? They don't realize the privilege that their class position engenders to them and don't see themselves as actually being part of that system, even though they are.
Yeah. He can choose to doff that and say, oh, no, don't call me sir. Call me Julian. I'd prefer if you'd just call me Julian.
Which makes O'Brien extremely uncomfortable.
Super uncomfortable. He's like, oh, sure, Julian.
it's a great moment. It's very well acted. So what's the actor's name, Marshall? Can you?
Cole Meany.
Cole Meany does an excellent job in that scene. It's very well acted.
He's a delight.
Yeah, he's amazing. And yeah, so they have that interaction, and you know, and it's this whole thing of like Bashir really wants O'Brien to like him, but he hasn't. He needs O'Brien to genuinely like him, and he can't command him to do so. And so there's like, and this And what's playing out there, I think, is a real thing that happens in a class-based society, where you have people who want to hold power over others, but they don't want to feel like they're coercing people around them. They want to feel loved and liked as they do it. And that's a real tension for them. And what they do is they just actually kick that down to their lessers. Like, well, do you like me? and ostensibly
is that an order?
Yeah, and use their power to force that person to lie to them, which only makes the exploitation that you're experiencing more psychologically painful. And this is, I think, a very common thing that exists, and it's a huge dimension of the of class struggle and the how it works psychologically.
And they played it very well.
Indeed.
So Bashir and O'Brien end up on Bajor, and everyone says, oh, there's a medical emergency. This whole village is going to die. And they find out that it's one elder is ill, and he's dying of old age. How does Bashir describe it?
Accelerated cellular decay or something like
yeah,
that.
Accelerated cellular decay.
Just like, in short, he's old.
Organ failure brought on by accelerated cellular decay. Yeah,
that's what it is.
In short, he's dying of old age.
Yeah, so
the old man is dying. Yeah. He is a storyteller.
What's his title?
Sarah. Because every year for 5 days, a monster comes and threatens the village and will destroy the village if the Sarah is not there to defeat it. And the Sarah defeats the monster, the Dalrock, by standing on a rock and proclaiming to the village that we are stronger and our unity is what defies the Dalrock. And so long as we remain united and steadfast, the Dalrock shall not defeat us. This village has a literal other to unite them.
Yeah, and it comes every year. But the thing is, if you're not actually united, this other will literally fuck up your shit.
Yes.
they will straight up murder you. So the stakes are high, I guess. On kind of his last night, though the last time he repels the monster, he kind of names O'Brien as his successor. And O'Brien is extremely uncomfortable about this.
Very uncomfortable.
You know, so he's like, yeah, you're the messiah of this village now. And you know, so then they're like all trying to bring him like fruits and weird vases and people to have sex with. And he's just all very extremely uncomfortable with the whole thing.
Yes.
And he's just like, what am I going to do? I do not know what this job entails. I am a highly trained engineer, and being involved in situations with very vague technical specifications causes me huge anxiety. So he's just trying to figure his stuff out. And then the Sarah's like butler tries to kill him.
The Sarah's apprentice.
The Sarah's apprentice.
The butler.
The butler did it, Marshall. Yes, so the Sarah's apprentice then tries to kill him because he's jealous. And then, you know, Brian's like, hey, I didn't want this to happen either. You should clearly be doing this. You know what's going on. And so then O'Brien tries, he fails, the apprentice steps up, receives the mantle. Bashir's like, see, I knew O'Brien could not have been chosen over me. And clearly he was only chosen for his ineptitude, and the Sarah rejected me because I would be so charismatic as to succeed and would thus cockblock his apprentice.
Yes.
Which is how basically Bashir describes it.
It is. I think though he's sort of right, like in the way that like arrogant people sometimes are. Yeah. He was absolutely right, because the whole time O'Brien was very uncomfortable with this and was like, I don't want to do this job. I can't do this job. Bashir, given the opportunity to lead a crowd of adoring people with whom he's allowed to have sex, would immediately step up to the task.
All right, yes, we are doing that. I will be so charismatic and terrifying.
Right, like, yeah. We are united. Yeah, you know why we're united.
Yeah, eat it, Dalrock. Yeah, Bashir would, he'd do it. Anyway, so yes, so, and that's essentially, so then the apprentice steps up, and the Dalrock is, I guess, just a weird cloud.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weird monster design.
It's a cloud that shoots out
little lumps of smaller cloud.
Tendrils of cloud.
Yeah.
But those cloud tendrils can actually shatter rock.
And that's all it ever does.
I don't think, yeah, it never hit a person.
The explosive yield on them is pretty low. And to be fair, I don't see Star Trek being like, my arm!
I mean, you do see some people, though, like, that die in explosions or
get
shot. Yeah,
they're just kind of like...
But no, we're obviously not going to see anybody, like, lose their arm. Yeah. But you could see an explosion that hits in the middle of the crowd and some people fall over.
Yeah,
which we don't see. The other that unites them is beneficent in its...
It shoots wide. I just give it
one over the bow.
Yeah.
Just as a warning shot, like... Yeah. Make sure you guys know that I'm a real terrifying monster.
It's not out to get bodies. Yeah.
I think, though, that this is sort of like the beginning of Bashir and O'Brien, like, falling in love.
Yeah, there's an arc.
This is their bromance.
Yeah.
It's building. Because when they get back, they're like, there's a little bit more jokiness with them.
Yeah. They're becoming,
you know.
Well, I think one of the things is at the end, Bashir says, you don't have to call me Julian. You can call me Sir. He drops that imperative, and that goes a long way to, you know, and that is actually genuinely accommodating to O'Brien, even though it increases the formality in that relationship. But that's actually what real relationships are. It's not informality that dictates it. It's actually about comfort and safety and, you know, everyone knowing where they stand, which is much more important than jokiness or nicknameification.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
That was those two episodes.
One episode. That's just one episode.
Oh, God. It was one episode. That was two plots. Just like every other Star Trek episode. There's literally hundreds of these.
We didn't talk about the oatmeal, but that's okay. Anyway, those are the two stories. That's the episode. That's the storyteller. It was good. This is probably the best episode to date. They are hitting their stride. No, it's too early to say
that. It's way too early to say that. You know that's a lie.
the next two are going to be real stinkers. They got to make up for this.
Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it here on the podcast. I know from Marshall and I, from the depths of our hearts, thank you for being a listener. Thank you for supporting us and telling all your friends about us, as I'm sure you do. If you want to get a hold of us, we would love to hear from you. You can email me, Steve, S-T-E-V-E-S-T-E-V-E, at androidsandassets.ca, or you can reach me on Twitter at SteveDroids. Marshall, what's your contact information?
You can reach me, Marshall, at androidsandassets.ca, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, at androidsandassets.ca, or on Twitter at econoboyd.
The show by tweeting us at Asset Droid or Instagramming us at Asset Droid as well. Come find us. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Emissaries of Prophets. We'll be looking at episode 14 and maybe episode 15. You know,
who knows?
They could be a couple of bad ones. And look forward to talking more Star Trek with you then.